Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments. Spiritual exercises in Snowdonia. And shining the spotlight on the forthcoming beatification of John Paul II, bringing you the witness of some of those who personally knew him. But first, I'd like to bring you Pope Benedict XVI's words this Wednesday during his weekly general audience with pilgrims from across the world. Emma McCarthy reports.
Violence and hatred are always a defeat.
La violenza e l'odio sono sempre.
For this reason, Pope Benedict XVI on Wednesday offered a new and urgent appeal to all involved in both the Ivory Coast and Libya, where conflict has been raging for weeks, to start the work of peace and dialogue and to avoid all further bloodshed. This was the appeal that rung out on Wednesday morning across a crowded St. Peter's Square at the end of the general audience. For the third time in as many weeks, Pope Benedict urged the international community to return to the path of dialogue and ensure the security and safety of the civilian populations of both countries. The Holy Father said he also hoped that Cardinal Peter Turkson, president of the Vatican's Council for Justice and Peace, whom he had sent as his personal envoy to Ivory Coast to express his solidarity with the population there, will soon be able to enter the country. According to the Apostolic Nuncio to Ivory Coast, the Cardinal was stopped in Accra from entering national territory. Earlier Wednesday, continuing his series of lessons on the great doctors of the Church, the Pope had turned his attention to a 19th century French woman saint whom the world would come to know as the Little Flower.
Our catechesis today deals with Saint Thérèse of Lisieux, the young Carmelite nun whose teaching of the Little Way of Holiness has been so influential in our time. Born and raised in a devout French family, Teresa received permission to enter the Carmel of Lisieux at the tender age of 15. Her name in religion, Sister Teresa of the Child Jesus in the Holy Face, expresses the heart of her spirituality, centered on the contemplation of God's love, revealed in the mysteries of the Incarnation and redemption.
In imitation of Christ, continued Pope Benedict, Teresa sought to be little in all things and to seek the salvation of the world.
Taken ill in her 23rd year, she endured great physical suffering in union with the crucified Lord. She also experienced the painful testing of faith which she offered for the salvation of souls who deny God.
Pope Benedict concluded that by striving to embody God's love in the smallest things of life, Teresa found her vocation to be love in the heart of the Church.
May her example and prayers help us to follow the little way of trust and love and the good of souls.
I'm Emma McCarthy.
Our thanks there to Emma McCarthy for sharing with us the Pope's words this Wednesday. And now why don't you join me as I speak to Jesuit Father David Birchall, who's the director of St. Bino's Ignatian Spirituality Centre, located in a stunning spot overlooking Snowdonia in the heart of Wales. You're a Jesuit and you're a director of an Ignatian Spirituality Centre in a place of sheer natural beauty, right?
It is, yes. It's in the valley of the Elwy, the Clwyd, and on the hillside overlooking Snowdonia.
Now, clearly you have the Ignatian imprint as a spirituality centre. Would you say that's the hallmark of your retreat house?
Yes, we're sort of set up here principally to do the exercises in various forms, and usually we do that nowadays in the form of an individually guided retreat, so people come along to the retreat center and spend anything from a weekend to the full spiritual exercises, which takes 30 days to do as a whole. Ignatius wrote the exercises back in Spain, really. They were first published in the 1540s. They're a combination, really, a sort of a looking at the life of Christ for the individual taken from Scripture, doing meditations. I mean, Ignatian contemplation, imaginative contemplation, is quite well known as a method of prayer, which is taking Scripture and putting yourself in the picture and just letting it develop. There's an element of that, and then there's an element also of looking at one's own life and where we're going with it, how we are responding to the call of God in life.
I read on your website that you speak about there being no room at the inn. One doesn't think of today's society as searching, in a sense, in an increasingly secular world. Why do you think you're so popular?
Well, there's an immediate popularity this year because at the end of last year, the BBC in Britain put on a television program, a short three-part serial called The Big Silence, and that showed five retreatants at our house having an individually guided retreat, and that has caused quite an influx of people. As you say, people who are not necessarily religious in the sense that they probably don't go to church, a lot of them, but they have a sort of sense of spirituality and wanting to sort of deepen that and look a little bit more at that. And so particularly the short retreats we've found are full this year. The longer courses, not so much, but the short courses, yes.
Before we get to the short courses, which are quite originally, I won't give too much away just yet, is there a typology of people who come to you? I mean, you say they're not necessarily practicing Catholics, but you have other people as well from other religions.
Yes, on the individually guided retreats, very often, certainly the shorter ones, we tend to find that something like half the people who come are probably Catholics. The other half are made up of other denominations and no denominations. A lot of Anglicans, but you know, I'm just looking at a retreat that today I was sorting one out, and there's Quakers and there's people who just call themselves Christian, and there's we've had Buddhists and we've had all sorts coming in over the last month or two.
Why do you think they come in? To find out more about Catholic Church, or because it's a particular place of spirituality? Is there a reason, do you think?
Very few of them, I think, want to know more about the Catholic Church specifically. That doesn't sort of motivate them to come, I don't think. They really want to have the space and the time to look at what's important in their lives. That's why one of the things that the program pushed was the silence. And a lot of people resonate with that they want a period of quiet away from the computers and the televisions and the radios and things, just a period so that they can look at their own life, reflect on what's really important in their own life. And some of them do want to sort of make contact again with a church that they've left, but in a way that doesn't sort of drag them in necessarily to sort of going to church every Sunday.
Now, getting to the actual themed retreats we mentioned a moment ago, a must in one of them seems to bring with you a book of poetry. Tell me about this Gerald Manley Hopkins connection.
Well, Gerald Manley Hopkins, a very popular sort of Victorian poet,
was a Jesuit
and did his theology. This was a theological college, St. Bino's, in those days, and he did 3 years theology here in St. Bino's. And I mean, the story is fairly well known that when he entered the Jesuits, he sort of burnt a lot of his poetry and gave up poetry. When he came here, the superior here suggested that he might like to write something about a recent tragedy, which was the wreck of a ship called the Deutschland. I think that was 1875. And he then wrote that, and that sort of opened the floodgates again. And he wrote a lot of his best poems, God's Grandeur, The Valley of the Elwy, The Sea and the Skylark, and The Windhofer, here in St. Bino's.
Beyond Gerald Manley Hopkins, you're very imaginative in the themes of your retreats. Mm. Among the current ones, I read Consider the Lilies, Praying the Labyrinth, and The Food Retreat.
Yes, they're all very different retreats. The lilies are looking at the garden and God's creation. The labyrinth has proved popular. We've had a labyrinth put out in the ground based on the Chartres Cathedral's labyrinth. And people find that very helpful. I think it helps them to sort of slow down. And they also see their own life in the twists and turns of a labyrinth which is always going to the centre which is God, but at the same time, everybody's life, I think, has its twists and turns, and I think that sort of resonates with people as they're doing it. The food, it's looking again at the importance of food in the sort of spiritual life, both things like the Last Supper, of course, but also that sort of sense of taking on board what we eat being important in our lives. These are things that we do as well as to sort of attract people who might not be looking for an individually guided retreat, but people do seem to like to have somebody else just to sort of bounce their spirit and bounce things off, as we do have on an individually guided retreat.
Can you tell me a little bit about yourself as director of Spirituality Centre? Is it a difficult job to have, or it's not just a job, it's a vocation, isn't it?
Location or vocation, I'm not certain. It's one of those jobs where you do have, I mean, I always try and keep a certain degree of work, contact in the work, so I give retreats fairly regularly in the centre, as well as doing the administrative work of keeping a place which has 20-odd employees on the domestic staff, as well as sort of about a dozen retreat givers paid to work here, plus lots of visitors. So there's quite a lot of administration to be done, and at the moment I'm sort of working out the programme for 2012. But I enjoy the mixture, really. And it's always a challenge to try and make a place like this, if not pay our way, at least sort of not demand too much of a subsidy from our central offices.
You meet a lot of people, don't you?
We do. There's thousands come through the doors in a year, literally a couple of thousand, so we meet an awful lot. And one of the things that's good about directing retreats, I find, is that you get to know people very quickly, very deeply. You know, they open up. So it's not just the superficial conversations, but you're sort of into deep human stories, as I say, very quickly in a retreat. So it's quite a privileged position that way. The number of people who go away feeling so much sort of lighter, or to give them the confidence in their own life, to see where God is acting in their own life and has been acting, something that's sort of repeated again and again as retreatants go away. And also, one of the things about the job is that you can't control it as a retreat giver. You're never in control of what goes on. It's always that the people, you may suggest a scripture passage, you may suggest a way of praying to somebody, then off they go to do it. And you never quite know what the Holy Spirit's going to get up to. So you can't plan one day for the next. You've just got to wait and see where the Spirit has been. Thank God the Spirit works quite regularly. One of the things we've been doing at St. Bino's for about sort of 30 years now are running courses, sabbatical courses for religious and priests. And we've also been doing how to give retreats, so in their courses of 10 weeks. And we're finding that more and more people are coming from sort of Africa and Asia, and Australia particularly, for these courses. It's great to have this international sort of feel to the place. We're having people coming on the 30-day retreats from all over the world, but particularly the longer courses, the 3-month courses, the 10-week courses, really do sort of give us an international feel to the centre.
You were listening there to the director of St. Bino's Ignatian Spirituality Centre, Jesuit Father David Birchall. Our thanks go to him. And now back to the Vatican, where on the 5th of April, a press conference regarding plans for the beatification of John Paul II, scheduled for the 1st of May, were released. Emma McCarthy again.
Cardinal Agostino Vallini, Vicar General for the Diocese of Rome, was joined by Monsignor Marco Frisina, the Director of the Diocesan Liturgical Office, and Vatican Press Office Director Father Federico Lombardi in a meeting with press Tuesday morning.
I santi sono il Vangelo incarnato.
The Cardinal Vicar revealed that from the outset, universal veneration, a prerogative that belongs to saints, was sought for the soon-to-be blessed, rather than the usual local veneration that is due to those who are beatified. The Cardinal Vicar went on to explain that the recognition will be announced during the beatification rite on May 1st, along with the date on which each year The liturgical memory of the newly blessed will be celebrated.
Una parola sulla veglia.
Then the full program for 3 days of celebrations for the beatification was presented, with the most surprises reserved for the vigil on April 30th in Rome's Circus Maximus Arena, beginning at 8 p.m. local time. Divided into 2 parts, the first will revisit the life and legacy of the late Pope. The second will see a worldwide recitation of his Mysteries of Light, or Luminous Mysteries, with decades led by Catholics beaming in via satellite from Marian sanctuaries in Poland, Mexico, Portugal, France, Tanzania and Lebanon. Before this, the holy icon of Our Lady, Salus Populi Romani, will be solemnly processed. Personal testimonies will be given by 2 of John Paul II's closest collaborators, former press office director Joaquin Navarravals and Cardinal Stanislaw Dziwisz, and by Sister Marie Simon-Pierre, whose miraculous recovery from Parkinson's disease opened the way for the beatification process, while the notes of that hymn synonymous with John Paul II's pontificate, Totus Tuus, Holy yours, Mary, fill the night sky. That night, across Rome, 8 churches will remain open and lit for pilgrims' prayer.
La messa di beatificazione avverrà il 1° maggio in Piazza San Pietro, come sappiamo.
On May 1st, the first Sunday after Easter, the Feast of Divine Mercy, the vigil, the waiting, will draw to an end, with an hour of prayerful preparation in St. Peter's Square. At 9 a.m. local time, pilgrims will recite the Chaplet of Divine Mercy, a devotion first introduced by St. Mary Faustina Kowalska and most dear to the soon-to-be-blessed. At 10 a.m. Rome time, the Mass for the Beatification of John Paul II will begin.
Le Grotte Vaticane.
Answering journalists' questions Tuesday, Father Federico Lombardi explained that the coffin of John Paul II, which shall not be opened, will be transferred before the tomb of St. Peter in the Vatican Grotto that weekend. On the morning of May 1st, it will be brought before the altar of confession in the Basilica. From that evening, all those who wish to do so may come to St. Peter's Basilica to venerate the soon-to-be-blessed John Paul II. Father Lombardi ensures that the Basilica will remain open until the last pilgrim wishing to do so has knelt in prayer. I'm Emer McCarthy.
And now, having listened to Emer McCarthy, I'd like you to join me as I step back in time and listen to some of those who personally knew John Paul II, who, in a series of interviews I did during this Polish pontiff's lifetime, offer their personal witness. Among them, one of the cardinals who took part in the conclave to elect the Polish pontiff. He's American, William Wakefield Baum, who cherishes memories of time spent with Cardinal Wojtyła in Poland only months before he was elected to the See of Peter. Among the other guests are a childhood friend, a Polish countess, and a one-time personal friend, who recounts how, in his opinion, what made John Paul II so much the Pope of the third millennium was his experience of suffering. So do make yourselves comfortable, as in a few moments you'll be able to listen once again to the voice of John Paul II speaking in English in the early days of his pontificate. Stay tuned.
Sometimes we may wish for a kind of life that is easier than the one we have. But in the providence of God, a different life does not mean a less important life.
We were forbidden to have any culture, any education whatsoever outside elementary education. And we had schools and universities in clandestinity, including university and maturity exams and concentration camp.
And that was the world the future Pope grew up in, the same one remembered by Polish Countess Wanda Jabuszyckańska.
The Czechoslovakian border as a young bishop, and passed the border, and he was arrested by the Czechoslovak police. He likes very much the mountains, and and he used to go a lot with the students. And they called him uncle because sometimes he couldn't even show he was a priest. He just went with them as a good uncle.
I would like to offer my greetings and my blessing not only to you, but to all your colleagues throughout the world.
And when the newly elected Pope met with the press for the first time in his pontificate, a mysterious lady cried out Wujek, uncle, in Polish. Professor Stanisław Grigiel, a one-time personal friend of Karol Wojtyła, was at that press conference.
Il Papa passa, ma non la vede, e lei non sapendo cosa fare, gridò.
Journalists at the press conference were startled by this Polish lady who suddenly addressed the Pope as uncle. What they didn't know was that this was a common way of addressing a Catholic priest in communist Poland, where to identify him openly as father was far too risky. The mystery lady had taken part in one of the secret retreats held by Uncle Wojtyła up in the mountains. In those years of religious intolerance, discretion became the price of religious survival. We were forced to keep such activities secret because the police were always on the lookout for us. Had they found out what was really going on, we would all have had to pay a very high price.
Ma sempre nascondendosi perché era vietato e la polizia ci cercava e questo era pericoloso.
This was the scenario in which the young Karol Wojtyła began his priestly life. His personal life prior to this had taught him to live with suffering.
I don't remember very well his mother because she died when we were still little. The much older brother who died when we were about 11 or 12. The brother was a doctor, medical doctor.
Jerzy Kluger went to school in Wadowice with Lolek, as the future Pope was familiarly known.
And contracted scarlatin fever, scarlet fever.
Scarlet fever.
Yes, and died. It was a big tragedy. And, you know, it came only a few years after his mother died. And they were left in two of them, the father and the son. And father was then already retired from the Polish army. So he lived with his son there in that little flat near to the church and was teaching, was sacrificing his whole life to that boy.
Lei ha menzionato il millennio, Papa del millennio. Penso che le esperienze che si chiamano oggi Auschwitz e Colima.
I believe that what makes him so much the Pope of the third millennium is his experience of suffering, the fact that he was touched so personally by the era in which he lived. Many of his close friends at school were tortured, deported to Siberia, or interned in concentration camps. It was this indirect experience of Auschwitz or Coema that inspired him to want to save others from suffering, to defend the rights of the human person.
No one born into this world is free from human frailty, whether it be physical, emotional, or spiritual. Each of us must personally come to terms with this frailty.
I am Jewish. My father was the last president of the Jewish community in Wadowice. We don't talk very often about it. I mean, he, I suppose, wants to avoid this because, for me, those years are really very painful, those memories. And during the war, we did a tremendous mistake that went into the army, that means my father and myself, and my mother, my sister, and the grandmother were left there. We thought that the Germans won't do anything to them because they're women. Instead, they all died in Auschwitz.
The Cardinal Archbishop Krakow took me personally to Auschwitz. He accompanied me. On many other occasions, he would arrange for me to go here and there to see this and explore that. But he took me personally to Auschwitz and spoke to me about it. He understood fully what Auschwitz was and even the symbolism of it. And we went together and we knelt and prayed together in that spot.
American Cardinal William Wakefield Baum was one of the cardinals who took part in the conclave that elected the Polish Pope. He cherished memories of time spent with Cardinal Wojtyła in Poland only months before he was elected Pope.
Cardinal Archbishop of Krakow was the preacher of the day, and he preached this magnificent, stirring homily, delivered with great passion. I couldn't understand Polish, but there was a priest always with me to interpret, so I knew what he was saying. He was encouraging these working men to be true to their faith and to stand tall, be courageous. He was a great defender of the rights of the working man, of ordinary citizens vis-a-vis the powers of this world, the political powers, especially in Poland. It was not a revolutionary speech, but it was a speech that was meant to put steel into the minds, the hearts of these working Polish men. That day there were at least 300,000 of them present for this great mass in a field. So that, of course, gave me another insight into his personality. Cardinal Wojtyła of Krakow was one of the most prominent cardinals in the world and much admired, looked up to, I'd say, by his brother cardinals.
I do hope you enjoyed that feature I put together for you. Don't forget that we have a special icon on our webpage referring to the pontificate of John Paul II. Our web address is www.vaticanradio.org. The online menu will guide you through. Our particular feature program is on English World. Meanwhile, should you wish to write to us, our email address is english@vatiradio.va. Otherwise, drop us a line by snail mail. The address is English Programme, Vatican Radio, Vatican City. And that brings me up to time. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. We'll be back again at this same time tomorrow, so do join us then. Bye for now. You've been listening to the English Programme of Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.